Hello, hello. Welcome. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and this is Final Draft. You have tuned into Final Draft, and it is books, writing, and literary culture. I absolutely love reading books, and every week after reading fantastic new Australian writing, I get to speak to the authors. I get to share those conversations with you to help you discover new Australian writing, to help you get a little bit more out of that experience, maybe discover something new in the books that you are reading. How is your reading going, by the way? I am absolutely loving just the wealth of Australian writing that is being published. I wish I had more time for it. I wanted to share something that I've actually discovered really recently. I don't know if you remember or if you ever did this when you were a kid, doing readathons. I think MS Readathon was one that I participated in when I was a student. Well, I have discovered that there is a fantastic book reading, fundraising thing that you can get involved in called Booktober coming up, surprisingly, in October. Not really surprisingly. It comes from Westwards, and Westwards are an organization that are dedicated to celebrating and championing the story of people, places, and cultures that comprise the heart of Western Sydney. So this is our city, and this is Westwards doing so much for young people in Western Sydney. And Booktober is an opportunity for you to read books and raise money for Westwards. You get to sign up to be a bookworm. You get to decide how many books you're going to read, and you spread the word. You ask people to sponsor you to read. It reminds me exactly of what I did, you know, when I was young and at school, and you would always like have competitions with your friends. I just could not imagine competing to read nowadays, and Booktober and Westwards have given us that opportunity. So if you want to find out more about Westwards, you can go to westwards.com.au. But most importantly, if you want to get involved in Booktober, you can go to booktober.org.au. Now, I want to hear more about your reading, and you can find Final Draft on social media at Final Draft 2SER. Let me know what you're reading. Let me know if you've signed up for Booktober. But if you're looking for a book to read, today on the show, I want to introduce you to Paul Dalgano's Polly. Paul is an absolutely fantastic writer. His journalism is incredible. And Polly is his first novel. He released a memoir a few years ago as well. But Polly is his first novel about a couple who have decided to try and figure out and fix their relationship by opening it up, becoming polyamorous. And as Chris discovers, Chris, our protagonist, that twice the love can also mean twice the effort. It is an absolutely thrilling, amusing, and psychologically challenging novel. That is Paul Dalgano's Polly. It is coming up on Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and that will be the show. First, I just want to share a very short message.
Live music in New South Wales is under threat. Without government intervention, 85% of New South Wales live music venues could be lost within 12 months. Over 60 independent live music venues have joined together to launch an online petition calling on the New South Wales Government to provide immediate support to save the state's live music industry. Go to sosnsw.org and sign the petition to help save our live music scene.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, books, writing, and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined on the line by Paul Dalgano. Paul was born in Aberdeen, Scotland, and came to Australia in 2010, which I'm pretty sure under Australian law means that whenever he's successful, we are absolutely claiming him as an Aussie. Paul is a journalist and a writer. His first book, And You May Find Yourself, is a memoir. And today, he's joining me to discuss his first novel, Polly. Paul, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Now, I am absolutely chomping at the bit. I'm so excited to be discussing Polly. I thought we will start with a bit of a content warning for listeners because the conversation, by the nature of the book, will probably delve into sex, but also mental health issues. And for anyone listening, if you want to tune out, this might be a good time. But also, if these are things that are present in your life and you need support, you can call Lifeline on 131114. And with that sort of little note to people, Paul, we'll talk about the fact Polly. So it's the story of Chris and Sarah, or perhaps it's the story of Chris and Biddy, or it might even be the story of Chris and Zach, because Chris and his wife have decided to be polyamorous. After years of a nearly sexless marriage, Chris figures this is the way to get something back into their relationship. But while being poly may mean twice the love for Chris, he's also finding out it's sometimes more than twice the work. And what really struck me, Paul, as I read this, you know, the novel, it opens with Chris reading a text from Sarah about a hookup that she's had at a party. They've agreed to this open relationship, but Chris, he kind of has this refrain throughout that goes something like, this is weird, or is this weird? Now, open relationships, they make up a small but still a significant portion of the population. I feel like most of us who aren't in one, they don't have a reality check or a reference point for these situations. For me, it had the effect of destabilizing my experience of Chris's reality. I didn't know what to make of it. Is this real? Is this not? I wondered whether you wanted to start off and give the reader this slight kind of cognitive dissonance.
Well, I think that's a really good point to come in on, actually, Andrew. I think what happens in this type of open relationship, or rather what happens before it, is there's an element of fantasy involved. So lots of couples, I think, judging by anecdotal evidence and real evidence, like the idea, or at some point in the relationship, particularly a long-term relationship, entertain the idea of seeing other people or having a fling or somehow spicing up their relationship. The big kind of difference between the fantasy and the reality, like all fantasy and all reality, is as soon as these things become reality, all of the theoretical or, you know, heart-to-hearts that you've had about it, in a way, go out the window in the sense that suddenly you're not dealing with fantasy, you're dealing with real other people with real feelings, real sensitivities, whose kind of game plan or idea of how things should work in the world has nothing to do with you as the dominant couple or the dominant pairing. So I think the reality there is that there is a dissonance, because what has been built up in this case in between Sarah and Chris is an idea of something they will do, and an idea of how that will then feed back into their relationship and hopefully strengthen it, maybe make it more exciting. But as soon as that comes up against reality, there's a kind of twin thing going on where the fantasy suddenly crumbles against the harsh reality of life in practice.
Chris here, he presents a very interesting figure of masculinity for our modern world. Did you want to challenge through Chris and through the various male characters, but predominantly Chris, what it means to be a man?
Yeah, I really did. And that's because personally, I find that whole area really fascinating. I think it always has been, but particularly in the last few years with Me Too and preceding Me Too, everything that led up to that moment and everything that's come from it has really forced me back in on myself to think, what does masculinity mean? But also something that was quite influential for me in the process of writing the book was a study that came out in, I think, 2017, by the University of Melbourne, where it was a longitudinal study, so over 4 or 5 years, I think, with 40,000 men in Australia, looking at the kind of factors that might lead to suicidal ideation or, sadly, in some cases, suicide. And from everything, so that there were what we might think of as common factors, so alcohol abuse, or lots of alcohol drinking, basically being single, being lonely, employment instability. But interestingly, what they found in that study was the number one factor contributing to suicidal ideation and suicide for men was a notion of self-reliance, which is right at the heart of how we're socialized as men and how we, I guess, tend to see ourselves as men, that we're self-reliant. So that the classic, the classic idea, basically, if a man has a problem, they suck it up and they bear it. And that very act of bearing it and being seen to bear it and not whine about it is in itself somehow masculine. But the horrible dark side of that, of course, is we have men walking about all over the place, feeling unable to express what it is that's troubling them or the many things that are troubling them. And then that is ultimately buckling a lot of men and leading to these disastrous outcomes.
So we have Chris and Sarah, and in opening up their relationship, they have to practice, I guess, a kind of radical openness and honesty in the way they communicate to make that open relationship work. While Chris struggles with this, it also sort of, I guess on the surface, it looked like a kind of ideal communication. In some ways, they were talking to each other in ways that we don't typically think partnerships always do. I soon realized, though, that this level of honesty, it left space, I guess, for even more insidious lies or omissions. When you're telling each other so much, the things that you leave out have so much more portent. Do you think that relationships really do need to communicate everything, or is it important that there are spaces untouched?
My view on that is that all successful relationships require quite a lot of lying, in the sense of white lying. It's the classic when you ask your partner or your partner asks you whether your bum looks big in something, you know, the answer is no. And not only is the answer no, it has to be immediate. The pause before saying no is as dangerous as saying yes or as hurtful. So I think there are structures there and ways of being in all relationships that for kindness sake, it requires us to lie, to tell white lies to each other. And similar to what I was saying before about the difference between theory and reality, there's a tension there too, where in theory, complete honesty between partners is a beautiful thing. And in a lot of ways, I believe in that idea. I believe that the best way to grow in a partnership is to be as radically honest as you can. But that's not necessarily going to lead to a more friendly or feeling of connection with your partner if you actually speak your mind. So it's a balance.
You really beautifully evoke that in the book. And I want to just ask you quickly about that stylistically, because you in some of these conversations are such a close study, and you notice or you present those ominous pauses. Did you find, was that something that came naturally, or was that part of your editing process where you realized some of these tiny, tiny moments contained so much?
That's actually something that I almost can't remember how I did it, because it was so involved and over so many iterations. But one thing that did happen when I was writing the book is the initial draft I wrote was 180,000 words long, which is just, you know, ridiculous, way too long. And I think the final version, after many redrafts by me, is at about 90,000 words long, more or less. So one of the things I did in that kind of shrinking it down and compressing it was taking what were maybe two or three chapters and kind of squishing them into one chapter. So in some ways, with the dialogue and the kinds of things that were being said, they became part of that process too, which was taking out as much as I could without the whole thing falling over, and just leaving enough for there to be lots of ambiguity and things being misunderstood, and space in there for not necessarily deception, but people getting the wrong end of the stick, as they do in real life. So yeah, it's a real process, but for sure, I mean, the most direct answer to your question is I was looking very, very closely at the dialogue and was aware of what I was trying to achieve in each of the scenes that's in the book.
Did you find, I mean, I loved the characters. I loved the way they communicated with each other, but I don't have that necessarily in all of my relationships. Did you find you were trying to write realistic dialogue, or were you going more for something more idealized that helped you realize the story?
I was going as realistic as I could. And actually, my background is journalism and feature writing. And then I wrote a memoir, as you mentioned in the introduction. And throughout all of that, dialogue isn't a huge focus, but it is in there. So you've got your editing down quotes, you know, as you would know in your line. If you transcribe a 1-hour interview, it's going to be about 3,000 or 4,000 words, maybe more, which you then need to pick out 600 words for your 1,000-word article, which leaves a bit of room for analysis and introduction and things. So there's always a process of trying to pick out in nonfiction, in trying to pick out the pertinent bits of a conversation or the pertinent ways of capturing something in a small amount of space. And for this book, it's way more dialogue driven than anything I've done before. And that was one of the big skilling up things I had to do in writing. It was actually learning how to make that dialogue happen. So quite a lot of it might have sounded wooden in the first couple of drafts. And my process there was to keep reading it out loud and getting other people to read it out loud to me, and just trying to, the same as in nonfiction writing, trying to get something that worked well on the page, but also sounded like things people would actually say, which isn't necessarily that easy. You know, sometimes, again, when you're working off of a transcription, when you actually see what people say in spoken language, it doesn't often make that much sense. In written language, it doesn't work on the page. So there's always this slight kind of polishing and turning things around until they sit just the right way. So yeah, a process of discovery, I guess, with the dialogue.
All killer and no filler. So the need for love and affirmation, that runs throughout. Each of the characters has their moments where they are feeling they need more love, they need affirmation. And I found this was really beautifully highlighted in the juxtaposing of scenes between Chris's kids, Sophie and Oliver, who sort of seem to suffer a bit at the vagaries of all the relationships around them, but through juxtaposition of those scenes with those of the adults and how the behaviours are often dark and hilarious in their similarity. Did you find, was this a regular human frailty, this almost juvenile behaviour, or was it perhaps something darker?
In terms of the need for affirmation?
Yeah, one of the features of this book is that we have Chris is 40 or recently 40, and Sarah has a birthday during the book. And there is a sense that part of this is spurred on by an understanding and an acknowledgement of their age, and perhaps their behaviours are taking them back to a younger time. And that really shone through when we saw their reactions and the reactions of Sophie and Oliver, who are, I guess, allowed to be a little bit more juvenile and childlike.
Yeah. I think that idea of aging and the ever-growing awareness of mortality is definitely threaded throughout the book. But one of the key drivers of the entire story is an old extramarital relationship that Sarah had with a man called Nikau, who took his own life a couple of years before the book started. Chris regularly throughout the book laments the fact that his mum died a couple of years ago. And both of them, I think, as a couple, as you say, they've both recently turned 40. They've been living in this world of raising children and not seeing anyone, not going out anywhere for 8 or 9 years. And I think, yeah, they both do have a very strong driver within them to somehow cling on to life and to cling on to the kind of vital side of life before the lights darken, as it were.
The need for love and the lengths that the characters will go to, you also highlight this, I think, in a really careful placing of a beautiful hardback edition of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And here is the dark heart and perhaps one of the most thrilling aspects of Polly, which I will most assuredly not be revealing. But I wanted, if you could just in general terms, talk to me about weaving psychological thrills and leaving little intertextual clues in your work.
I really can't remember who said this, so it's a bit of a shame in some ways. But I think it was maybe Nabokov. But somebody at some point said that you don't read a book the first time you read it; you read it the second time you read it. So the first time is really to map out the whole area and you get a sense of the story and you follow it along. But then if you enjoy that book and you go back and read it again, if the writer's done the job, as you said, of kind of leaving things around, you'll actually find a different story, a richer story. And in this case, for sure, by the time people get to the end of the book, were they to read it again, absolutely for certain, they're going to find things in there that they didn't the first time around. And part of that is with Chris being all the things we've already discussed, you know, so slightly self-obsessed, completely exhausted, giving his time to everyone else and not to himself and suffering the consequences, et cetera, et cetera. It's really, in a lot of ways, a book about distraction. So Chris is our unreliable narrator. I mean, he's reliably Chris, but then is Chris actually seeing the world in a reliable way? And probably not, because he's completely distracted at every single moment of the book, which allows me then as the writer to have dropped in lots of things there that as a reader, if you were to go back through and look at the story again, you would say, oh, these are the things Chris are missing, because they're there. They're there in some ways really obviously in the book. It's just that Chris himself doesn't see it.
I am speaking with Paul Delgano, and his novel is Polly. If you have got anything from this conversation, it is that Polly is a constantly surprising book that is well worth your time. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Thank you, Andrew. I love your readings and your insight on the book. That's really gratifying for me too.
Paul and I have been discussing his new novel, Polly. And as part of that conversation, we did touch on mental health, mental illness, mental well-being, and also suicide. Now, if this conversation has brought up anything for you, if these are issues that are affecting you in your life, or if you're concerned about someone else, do know that help is available. You can call Lifeline on 131114, particularly at this time of, COVID is raging around the world, and it has put a lot of stress on so many of our lives. And this is a really tough thing for everyone. This is something that will touch all of our lives at some point. So know that help is available. I'm gonna say the Lifeline number again on 131114. You can also go to lifeline.org.au. They have a service where you can text, and this is something that I guess can make it accessible for more people, because I guess if you're having trouble dealing with things in your life, it may be more difficult to reach out and talk to someone, but you can go to lifeline.org.au and text. You can also touch base with them if you just need some information or if you're worried about someone else. So this has been a big conversation that Paul and I have had. This is something that is affecting all of us. We are all going through more stress at the moment. And you need to know that help is available. I'm going to say that number once more, 131114. Thank you again to Paul Delgano. And if you missed any of that conversation, if you want to find out a little bit more about Polly, it will be going up online. It will be going up on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. So you can hear a little bit more from Paul and discover more about his fantastic new book.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Yes, you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and the show you are listening to is Final Draft. Every week, books, writing, and literary culture. Today on the show, we were discussing a fantastic new Australian novel. It's out through Ventura Press. It is called Polly. Paul Delgano, the author, Paul and I were discussing all of the issues that came up in the book, including things like mental health, relationships, and also just so many interesting things about the way Paul has, I guess, sort of leveraged his experience as a journalist to write a story like this, particularly some of the incredible dialogue that he creates. Now, if you want to hear more about Polly, if you missed anything in the conversation, or if you just want to like catch the expanded interview, you can tune in to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Maybe I don't mention this often enough, but every week I chat to these authors, and often the conversations go far and wide, and it's more than I can fit on the air once I share some of the other amazing stuff that's going on in the book world. But the full conversation is always available on the podcast. So wherever you catch your podcasts, you can discover more. Now, I was just sort of flicking back through what we've covered recently, and if you want to discover great Australian writing, we've got authors like Rawa Aja's The F Team, which is another fantastic Sydney story for young adults. Laura Elvery's Ordinary Matter, which is an incredible short story collection. We've got Jock Sarong's The Burning Island, which, if you know Jock's writing, incredible historical fiction. And even things like Kate and Joel Temple's The Battle of Book Week, which here in New South Wales. It's about to be school holidays. I would be wanting a copy of some of Kate and Joel Temple's books on my bookshelf if I had kids at home. That is the Great Conversations podcast. If you need a short bite-sized recommendation, there is also the 2SER Book Club up on the podcast. So tune in wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a comment, leave us a rating. I love knowing what you are reading. Now, it's almost time for me to go. I got to say goodbye. There are more incredible shows coming up on 2SER. Stay tuned for the stories, ideas, and music. And I'm going to leave you with a little bit of music. I have actually got something new from Alana Stone. Now, I love Alana's work in All Our Exes Live in Texas. Just one of my favorite Australian bands. But this is Alana Stone solo. She is, this is not an All Our Exes song. The song is called Permanent Limbo. And she writes about it being about the end of a relationship. But I sort of feel like a lot of us might think Permanent Limbo speaks to our current COVID lives. If you want to find out a little bit more about that, go to Alana Stone's Bandcamp. It is a terrific way to support local Australian artists in this time when the arts are going through so much. We will get live music back, but till then we need to support these artists. So here we are. I'm going to say goodbye from Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and this is Alana Stone's Permanent Limbo. Till next week, happy reading. Bye now.
What did you think would happen? One foot in. Food.